Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Men's Monday here on Mind Talk. Every Monday, you and I have the opportunity to meet another man who has agreed to share his journey with us. Today's guest is Dr. Volker Sontag. And Dr. Sontag is a vice chairman emeritus at Barrow Brain and Spine in Phoenix, Arizona. He's actually a world-renowned spinal neurosurgeon and has been consistently voted as one of the best doctors in America. Dr. Sontag has pages of awards, pages of patents, and scores of publications. Welcome, Dr. Sontag, to Mind Talk. I'm very pleased to have you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Now, Dr. Sontag, you've heard me describe all the things that you have accomplished, but that is now, and I'd like for us to start a little bit further back when you were a young boy growing up where?
In Germany.
And can you tell us about your early recollections of growing up in Germany?
Sure. I was born in what is at that time Prussia, Eastern Germany, right at the end of World War II. And then as the Russians advanced, my mother fled with me as an infant and my older brother and ended up in a refugee camp in Northern Germany for 4 years. My dad was a dentist for the German army on the Eastern Front and was not with us, but he eventually found us. And then after 4 years of living in this refugee camp, he found a job in a small town in middle of Germany. The town is called Bad Hersfeld, and where he started practicing. And I had a younger brother came along, and the three of us grew up in West Germany until in 1952, when my dad was diagnosed of having a brain abscess and had surgery for that, and then was handicapped and couldn't practice dentistry anymore. And my mother now, with three sons and an invalid husband, decided to immigrate to America and through the Lutheran Church, and after applying in 52 or 53, it took 4 or 5 years to find what they call a sponsor, and that sponsor was a kind man in Phoenix, Arizona, named George Bichelle. And in 1957, we got on a boat, and after 11 days on the water, the Atlantic Ocean, came to New York, and then boarded a train and through Chicago and onward to the west. And in April of 1957, we arrived in Phoenix, Arizona. So it was a very adventurous time for a, at that time, 12-year-old boy racing through this unbelievable, vast, large country called America. The train that we were on was a Santa Fe Chief, and it had a double decker, so I enjoyed always going on top and watching this land race by me, and it was just fantastic. When we ended up in Phoenix, it was April, as I mentioned, and it was just such a different country. Anyway, that's how we got to America, and that was my growing up in Germany and coming to Arizona.
Well, let's go back a little bit to the refugee camp. You spent 4 years in that camp with your family. What are your recollections of those 4 years?
I more or less, the recollections were something that my parents told me, that we were living in Kwanzaa huts. There was no kitchen, no bathroom except the common kitchen, common bathroom. The only thing I really remember, and again, I was between my ages 1 to 3 or 1 to 4, was my younger brother being attacked by a rooster. I remember watching my dad with a shovel next to the rooster and trying to, you know, chase the rooster away. That's really the only memory I have. Once we got to the town where I grew up in West Germany, I remember all of that, but I don't remember very much of the refugee camp, mm-hmm. except what my parents told us, that it was many former Eastern Europeans living in Kwanzaa huts in a very tight quarters. And obviously food and water and all that was quite scarce.
It certainly sounds like a traumatizing experience, remembering it or not, for a little one.
Well, I think it was. I think, you know, I remember that you know, we had to wait in line for food. This, again, is something my parents told me, or my mom basically told us, that food and lodgings and water was very tough to come by. And we were talking about post-World War II Germany in a refugee camp, living in Kwanzaa hut in a time where the Eastern Germans were not very much welcomed, and the West Germans, because we were competing with the few resources that are now present in a devastating country that lost World War II.
When you arrived in America, certainly it was a very new world for you in a very new time. And at that point, your father had already been diagnosed and was back home. Is that correct?
That's correct. He was back home, but he really was quite handicapped. He had difficulty with his vision and difficulty with his coordination. So he had a heck of a time finding a permanent job in America, usually a clerk. I remember a couple of times I came home from school and my mom was basically crying because my dad got fired again from another job because he couldn't keep the job. So it was a trying times in the early days in America, although the people and the country was just to me, as a little guy, 12, 14 years old, I was just awed by the bounty, I guess, bounty and open arms that was presented to us when we came to America.
Open arms, but not welcomed by everyone. You talked about neighborhood children calling you a Nazi. You weren't quite sure what a Nazi was.
First time I ever heard the word was in Phoenix, Arizona. It was my parents made friends from another German couple, and I went over to see them or deliver something or get something, I forget. And I was walking away. I was talking German to the gentleman, and a boy that overheard us talking German, he says, "Oh, you're one of those Nazis." And I went home and asked my mother what a Nazi was. In post-World War II Germany, nobody talked about the war, and certainly nobody talked about the Nazis. So the first time I heard the word was in Phoenix.
And how did your mom explain to you what a Nazi was?
She told me that it was a party that my mom and my dad were not part of. It was that ruled Germany and that brought us into the war. And then Germany fought, to quote her, I remember this distinctly, fought the rest of the world and we lost.
This you talked about this child who referred to you as a Nazi. What was your experience like in school? Was school a positive experience for you here in America?
Very much so. Very positive. There was never, I would say, I remember one time running cross country in high school, and one of the persons I ran with says, well, let's race to the next post, lamppost. And I says, okay. And he says, you know you're going to lose because you lost two World Wars. And that was probably the reason I remember that, because probably one of the only times that I was referred to as a negative. The rest of it, 99.9%, was nothing positive, not but positive. In grammar school and in high school, I was very much welcomed by. And we were kind of a rarity. We Germans in Phoenix, Arizona, in the 50s and early 60s, we were very, very much of a rarity, and we were very much welcomed.
When you say that your family was waiting for a host family, What did that mean? What was a host family to do for you or to provide for you?
What I remember is that we immigrated to the Lutheran Church, and we owed them money, but the host family, Mr. Bichelle, and his wife provided us housing, and I think they provided my dad a job when we arrived here. And they were, you know, very much gave us a home. And I'm not sure how much that had to be paid back. I wasn't, my parents were private people, but all I remember then was waiting for us at the train station, took us to the home. The other interesting thing I remember was I sitting in the back of the car that picked us up from the train station, and I saw oranges growing trees, and I elbowed my older brother and says, look, oranges growing trees. I had no idea where oranges came from growing up in Germany. It was quite startling to me that that's where they were. And anyway, that's so. But on the whole, it was a very much of a positive experience. I mean, we had to work right off the bat. I worked as a 12-year-old. I was cleaning garbage cans and kind of a gopher for the people that worked at the trailer court. But to me, it was all a very much of an exciting, positive experience. I didn't mind working at all, and I remember my first check was $4 and I think 10 cents for the week. I was getting 35 cents an hour, which, you know, to me was heaven. I mean, I thought when that check showed up, I says, wow, this is a good country, $4 and 10 cents.
And all you had to do was to work for 1 week. It's amazing.
Yep, all you had to do is work for 1 week, cleaning garbage cans.
Times have certainly changed.
Yes, they have.
You know, it's always interesting to hear about what people find wonder with and at, and how many people absolutely take things for granted. You talked about always remembering that, discovering that oranges grew on trees. And, you know, for so many people, sure, oranges grow on trees and who cares and it's no big deal. So it's just interesting how much we very often take for granted.
I agree.
As you were growing up, going through junior high, high school, what kinds of aspirations did you have for yourself? And what kind of aspirations did your parents have for you?
I think my parents were in survival mode. I think they worried more about how to get food on the table more than anything else. My dad had a heck of a time keeping a job. My mom worked as a dental assistant, and after going to a school, how to write English and speak English. They, when during high school, they never came to anything that like the sporting events, or when I got into honor school and all that, the ceremonies. They just that was not part of their thinking, and I never blamed them for it. It was just they were more of a day-to-day, how can we survive to the next day mode. I myself thought it was just normal. I enjoyed my high school days tremendously. The people welcomed me. I had made good friends in high school. In fact, I still have friends that I made in high school that I still see now, and we laugh about the days in high school, playing basketball, running track and field, running cross country. School was very good to me. I enjoyed high school tremendously. I worked also high school initially on a chicken farm and then in Jack in the Box. But I thought it was all part of it. It was just the way it was. And I never thought about that I was in hardship, or I didn't think about, you know, after running cross country, I went to Jack in the Box, worked Jack in the Box, got on my bicycle and bicycled home. And the next day, the same repeated itself. And then I just thought that was the way it was, and I didn't mind it at all. I just did it.
It's always interesting that you really don't know what you don't know until you know it.
Right, exactly. I didn't know there was another, that I didn't have, that some people didn't work, and didn't, I didn't have to. In high school at recesses and lunch, I did my homework. I didn't go, you know, went out and played. I did my homework because I knew how to work. That after track practice or after basketball practice, went to work. So I did my work during recess and lunchtime and study hour, and went to work and went home, and next day repeated itself. But I never thought it was a burden or something bad happened. You know, I never blamed anybody. I thought it was just the way it was in high school.
So you were very much a part of your family's economy, literally.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I had to pay for everything myself, and then contribute. Sometimes my mom asked me for some money, and all the school books, all the clothing, everything. That was my duty to pay for that. That is correct. That was just, again, that was just the way it was.
At what point did you make a decision about medical school? Did something happen?
I always, through high school and college, I always thought I wanted to be a doctor. I don't know where that came from. My uncle, my father's brother, was an ear, nose, and throat doctor, and his two sons became doctors, but we had very little contact with them. I always thought I wanted to be a doctor. I didn't know what type of doctor, but I always thought I wanted to be a doctor. And again, I have no idea where that thought came from, but that was always my thought through high school and college.
And how did you do when you got into medical school?
Well, that was interesting because I did, you know, I graduated from Arizona State University in chemistry, summa cum laude. Again, I worked at Jack in the Box primarily 35 hours a week, and played sports. I was on the soccer team during the whole 4 years. Once I got to med school, I got a rude awakening. You know, that I was in the first class at the University of Arizona Medical School. There were 32 students, and I remember the first physiology test I took. And I studied like no tomorrow, and I got a C, and it was graded on a curve. And I says, holy Toledo. I mean, the problem was I was in with 31 other people who were just as ambitious and type A as I was, and I didn't realize that. I said, oh, I'm in a new competition here. So it was a wake-up call, that's for sure.
Well, I would guess as I look at your career that it was certainly a wake-up call that you answered to with a vengeance.
Well, I did. I mean, I took up the challenge. I thought I would study harder than the other guys, and I wasn't the brightest tool in the shed, but I certainly thought I always could outwork people. And so I that's what I did. I worked like this. I studied and kept my nose in the books, and ended up graduating, not the top of the class, but certainly towards the top of the class. And at the last year, my colleagues that I've been with now for 3.5 years voted me president of the class, and which was a nice gesture. And so I finished med school in fine form with we started off at 32. Four people were asked to drop out or dropped out, and then two transfers. So we ended up with 30 graduating the first graduating class in 1971 in Tucson, Arizona, at the University of Arizona.
Dr. Sontag, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to pick up with what your dreams and plans were as you graduated from med school.
Very good.
Folks, don't go away. We'll return in just a minute to continue the conversation with Dr. Volker Sontag, who is the author of Backbone, The Life and Game-Changing Career of a Spinal Neurosurgeon. We'll be right back. Dr. Sontag, we've gone from you being a little one in Germany, moving into a camp, and then ultimately coming to America, and now you are the president of your medical school class. You've graduated medical school, and you're about to launch into what as your career?
Into neurosurgery. I launched into a residency. During medical school, we went through the various specialties, internal medicine, obstetric, gynecology, pediatrics, etc. And I realized that my personality would fit best with the surgical personality. And as we rotated through neurology, I loved the idea of examining a patient and getting a history of a patient and trying to find out what the problem is by the physical and the examination and the history, where the problem was. So I loved neurology, but I realized that I was more of a surgical attitude, personality, and therefore neurosurgery seemed like a good fit for me.
What precisely are you defining as a surgical personality?
Well, I think very decisive a go-to type of individual, individuals that are less hesitant, more of a a personality that's more of a type A, I guess, individuals that act instead of talk. That doesn't mean it's good, but that's the type of individual surgeons tend to be.
As you made that decision to work as a neurosurgeon, were you getting support for that path from friends, family, and colleagues?
Not family, because again, my family was then in Phoenix, and they really didn't know what I was going to be. But I did get support from a neurologist named Bill Buxbaum, who's the one that sparked my interest in neurology. And when I told him that I wanted to consider neurosurgery, he immediately called up a friend of his who's going to be the new chairman at Tufts University in Boston, and said that he has an individual that's interested in neurosurgery, and that would he consider interviewing me. And so 3 weeks later, after borrowing $400 from my friends, I flew to Boston and had the interview. And after that interview, I went to Kansas, where Bill Buxbaum also arranged an interview for me. And I came back on a Saturday morning while I was in Tucson doing my internship. The phone rang, and it was Dick Frazier, who was an associate of Ben Stein, the chief at Tufts, says, "You got a job if you want it." Those were his words. I said, "Who is this?" He says, "Dick Frazier." I says, "I'll take it." So that was my interview process for neurosurgery, just like that.
Certainly sounds like you were fairly decisive.
I was. I wanted to be a neurosurgeon, and I interviewed at two places. The phone rang, and it says, "You got a job." And I says, "I'll take it, and I'll be in Boston next June."
And there you went.
And there I went. I had all my in June, middle of June. I bought a used 190 SL Mercedes for $1,000. And all of my worldly belongings fit into that car, including my friend who had a girlfriend in Baltimore. So he and I drove in my 190 SL Mercedes from Tucson to Phoenix, and then on to Baltimore, and then I dropped him off, and I went on to Boston. I lived in intern quarters until I could find a place to rent. And then I started my neurosurgical training in July 1.
That's a lot of miles to put on a $1,000 Mercedes.
It was a lot of miles, and the thing didn't go faster than 50 miles an hour. So we were in the car a long time, plugging along the highways.
It sounds like it. Now, your friend had a girlfriend. I don't hear you talking about any love interests.
Well, interesting you should mention that, because at the end of my internship here, I saw this girl in the Veterans Hospital, and I asked the secretary on the floor to get the phone number, which she did, and I called her, and we went out on our first date, March 17th, 1972, and they had a three-month relationship, and then the secretary said, you know, Dr. Sontag, I'll give her your phone number, but I'm going to tell her that you're going to Boston in 2.5-3 months. So, indeed, I after the very intense relation for 3 months, she went to Phoenix and to visit her parents, and I drove by her house, and it was raining, and we said our goodbyes, and she waved, and my heart was heavy, and I'm sure it was hurt, but that was it. And she came out once to Boston, I went out to Tucson to visit her, and then we didn't see each other for about a year and a half until Easter of 74, when my mother wanted us, the children, back, because my dad was dying of cancer. And I saw her at a party Saturday night before Easter, and we talked all night and decided that she would come back with me and live with me for the next 6 months. So after the Easter celebrations next day, I picked up at a house for a date on Sunday evening, and her dad was waiting for me. And her dad said, I need to talk to you. And so we went to the backyard in the patio, and he says, Lynn tells me that she's going to move back with you and live with you for the next 6 months. And I said, yes, we talked about that. And I remember this like it was yesterday. He says, well, young man, he says, what are your intention? And I kind of was pushed in the corner. I mumbled something, and somehow the word marriage popped out. And he said, well, if you're going to get married then, after the 6 months, why don't you get married now? And I said, okay. So Lynn came in, and I said, I think I just told your dad we're going to get married. And she says, we got to talk. So we got in a Volkswagen and drove to Circle K, which is a quick food place, in the parking lot, talked for about 2 hours, and decided to proceed with the marriage. That was Sunday, as I mentioned. On Wednesday, we got married in a Catholic church. And on Thursday, we flew back to Boston together. And that was 43 years ago.
And you flew back to Boston as Mr. and Mrs.
We flew back in Boston as Mr. and Mrs. Sontag. That is correct.
That's
and my friends and colleagues in Boston were quite astounded. My wife was even more astounded when she opened up the refrigerator and there was one can of beer in it, and that was it. And all the nurses and friends in Boston says, what do you mean you got married? I says, I got married.
That's quite a, shall I say, love story?
It was, and it's we've been married now, this April 24th, for 43 years.
So it
and
was...
Three children.
Three children, 43 years. It was indeed a love story.
Yep. And in fact, she just walked into the room here where we're talking and waving at me.
Well, wave back to her from our
okay.
End.
Thank you.
All right, so we've kind of figured out now what your social life was like. Some time ago, you actually were in the world press. You had performed surgery on a young man under extraordinary circumstances. He had a 3.5-inch nail in his skull?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
I was on trauma, what they call trauma call, got called to trauma, and this individual complained of a headache, severe headache. And I examined him, and it said, well, it started suddenly. He was on a roof with a nail gun, and other colleagues of his had a nail gun. And he said he suddenly had a headache. I says, how did that happen? He says, he was working, and all of a sudden he grabbed his head and had this severe headache. So I examined him, and I couldn't see much. It was a full head of hair. So we got an X-ray, and believe it or not, he had this long nail in his head. So what happened, one of his colleagues with the nail gun obviously shot him, and he, being busy nailing himself, just had the headache, didn't realize why it happened. So we then proceeded to take him to the surgery and taking the nail out. But it was, the X-ray was very traumatic. It was this very long 3-inch-plus nail in his head.
That's so hard. I mean, it certainly was in the world press. But that is just so hard to imagine that, first of all, someone could have a 3.5-inch anything anywhere in their body and not be aware of it. But then that you were able to actually remove it, and he was how at the end of surgery? Was he well?
He was well, but 2 or 3 days later, I went by ready to discharge him, and he developed a weakness on his opposite the side the nail was in, and he had a bleed at the site where the nail was. So we took him back to surgery and took back the blood clot, and eventually he was discharged totally normal, but he did have that complication of a late bleed.
What goes through your mind as a surgeon, as you're operating on a patient, someone you don't know from a hole in the wall, but you know that their life is literally in your hands, what's that like? What goes through your head? What goes through your heart?
Before the surgery, one is quite anxious, especially depending on the type of surgery. If it's a routine surgery, the anxiety is less, but if it's a difficult case, there's no question that the night before is restless. People say, you know, well, we just walk in. Well, we do just walk in and say, well, we're going to do the surgery. We say that. On the other hand, if the surgery is something that is complex and difficult, and we know that's going to be a tough go, there's no question that I personally am more anxious the night before than I would be in more of a routine case. On the other hand, every case is challenging. Even the most routine case can have its challenges. So that's the day before, the night before. Once I get in the operating room theater, all anxiety, everything's gone. I just focus. And it's just amazing how surgeons just focus. And they can have an alarm go off in the next operating room or fire going off, and you would not notice that. You just focus right there. You focus on trying to get the tumor out. You focus on trying to fix that unstable spine. It's just amazing how we're just focused. And then once the major part of the surgery is over, the difficult part, and we start closing up the patient, then I ask for them to put on some light music. The mood in the operating room becomes less intense. We close up, and then I go wait until the patient's awake, examine the patient, and then speak to the family. But once I'm in that surgical theater, I'm just focused on it, and all anxiety is gone. I'm just there to fix the problem. I'm there to operate.
The life of a medical doctor, I mean, we all know the stories of the challenges, both while in training, in med school, residency. We all know the challenges. The life of a doctor such as yourself, would you say that it had a negative, positive, or no impact on the quality of your marriage, on the quality of your family life?
That's a very, very good question. It's something I faced throughout my career as a doctor. My philosophy, and my wife can attest to that, is that what I call the great balance. And the way I did it, in order to stay married for 43 years and have 3 phenomenal children, is that when I operate, I have 1 cup of coffee in the morning. When I don't operate, when I have clinical days, 2 cups of coffee. I don't eat lunch. And so I started around 6, 6:30. And then I come home. I would say 90% of the time, unless it's an emergency or on the call, I'm home around 6 o'clock and have dinner with the family. I also coach soccer for 15 years and Little League Baseball for 5 years, and that is part of being a father, being a husband. So I try to balance my scientific life, my professional life, with my family life, and it's difficult at times. I was involved in organized neurosurgery and all kinds of organizations, and it was difficult. But I have tried to have that dinner each night with the family and with the children and talk about their day. I rarely, if ever, talk about my day. I left my professional life at the door of the hospital, and then I was a family man. And that seemed to have worked in my particular instances. I don't have that hour lunch. I don't have any breakfast. And it worked. And people say, how can you not eat in the morning and eat lunch? It just worked for me. That's the way it was. And I did that, and I did miss children going to school. I never saw my children take off to school. I was gone by then. On the other hand, I was there at night for dinner, and also the afternoons and the weekends belonged to the families, except the weekends that I was on call and had to take emergency call.
So that
was my way of doing it.
What I'm hearing is lots of attention, deliberate attention paid to your family, to your wife and children. What I don't hear is downtime for you, just you. Did you weave that into your lifestyle?
I thought that was, no, I did not. I thought that part was, being with my family was more important than personal. Although I was a runner, I ran a lot. I participated in marathons, and so I took some time off for running, which I guess was personal time. But I did do that. I at times when I trained for the half marathons and marathon, I would come home and have dinner and then take off for a run after the children bed, or take off run before they go to bed. So I guess, yes, I did take that time off for my personal time. But the emphasis was, once I'm out of the hospital, once I'm out of the office, it was on my family.
Okay. I'm not going to comment on the fact that you did not follow the doctor's orders and did not have breakfast. We know it's the most important meal of the day. I'm not even going to comment on it. I'm not going to comment on the fact that your idea of breakfast was either one cup of coffee or two. Just leaving all of that alone.
I know people have been saying that forever, and I understand that, and breakfast is the most important meal. But in my particular instance, it seemed to have worked, and I agree with you that that doesn't make any sense. And every time I talk to people about that, they say that, but that's just, that seemed to work for me.
Okay. Dr. Sontag, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, there's another remarkable surgery that you actually talk about very early on in your book, Backbone. And when we come back, I'd like for you to tell us about that little boy who you said, and I quote, "I knew then that as impossible as it sounded, I was somehow going to reattach that boy's head to his spine." We'll be right back. Dr. Sontag, at the risk of repeating myself, I'm going to repeat myself. Again, I just want to quote you because it is such a stunning comment. I knew then that as impossible as it sounded, I was somehow going to reattach that boy's head to his spine. That's probably one of the more jaw-dropping sentences in Backbone. Tell us about that experience. What was going on?
It was an early morning, and when one of my, I think it was a fellow, came to me and says, we got a case in the ER, 8-year-old little boy, and he showed me the x-rays, and I said, well, it looks like an occipital cervical dislocation, which means the head, occipital, is the base of the skull, and cervical is the part of the neck. And between the skull and the neck, there was a separation, which looked like it, but we had to verify by CAT scan. So I said, how's he doing? Well, he's got a ruptured spleen and broken bones, but he is moving his arms and legs. I said, that's very unusual. Let's. So I went to the emergency room and examined the patient, and indeed he was moving everything except he had a broken leg and was quite in distress. I said, let's get a CAT scan and MRI scan, and which we did, and indeed it verified that he had the head was separated from the spine, so the bone was separated, but his spinal cord was obviously still intact. This is very unusual, number one, for him to survive that, because rarely do patients survive that. Number two is that the transport, if the paramedics aren't careful, just a minimal amount of movement, there was nothing connecting the head to the spine, except the spinal cord, and the minimal amount of movement would transect the spinal cord. So the paramedics were phenomenal as far as transporting the patient to the hospital without injuring the spinal cord. So we got the diagnostic test done, and besides the showing the separation, there's nothing connecting the head to the spine except the spinal cord. He also had a blood clot in front of the brainstem. So I talked to my colleague, Robert Spetzler, and I said, you know, we got to reconnect. First of all, these are, as I mentioned, very unusual to survive this injury. And really, because they are unusual to survive, it really does one get the opportunity to fix it. And I said, I think we have to reconnect the head to the spine. I don't know how many times it's been done before, really, ever. And we have to take the blood clot out. So this was now about mid-afternoon. By 4 o'clock, we were in surgery, and the injury was early that day. This is all very unusual to operate that early, but we had to, because if he would have coughed or yawned or anything like that, he could have separated his spine. He could have transected his spinal cord, because nothing was connecting the head to the spine, as I mentioned.
How old was this? How
old was he? 8 years old.
8 years old. Okay, and this was a car accident.
He was a pedestrian walking his bicycle.
Okay,
and then got hit by a car, and then got dragged by the car, which is usual. The mode of these, what we call occipital cervical dislocation, happens. You get hit, and then you get dragged.
I see.
So we took him to surgery that afternoon, and Robert, under the microscope, took out the blood clot, and then I went ahead and reattached the skull with a technique that I've used once or twice before in degenerative disease, rheumatoid arthritis, but never in this instance, with wires and a rod that I devised, put him in a halo, and to our phenomenal surprise, next morning he was moving things. He had his one leg in the cast, which the orthopedic surgeon put in, and he was recovering from his spleen taken out, which the trauma surgeon took out because it was ruptured. But eventually, he made a complete recovery, which was unheard of in the late 80s, that somebody like that, number one, would diagnose this quickly, number two, take the surgery that quickly, and number three, had a successful treatment of reattaching the skull to the spine.
That must have brought a great deal of attention to you and to your skills as a neurosurgeon, yes?
Yeah, it was to my surprise that people, the press went quite excited about it. I remember coming home a couple of days afterwards, and the press was waiting for me at my house, wanting to interview me. It was kind of an eye-opening event where I would get calls from Russia on the telephone and wanting to interview me, and it was it made the headlines in Germany. The Stern, which is the equivalent to like a Time or a Newsweek magazine, it made the front cover of that. So it was it got a lot of attention, and I was kind of awed by the media that took so much attention to this case. Yeah, it was national and international news for sure, to my somewhat surprise.
With the amazing successes that you've had during your career, it would be easy for you to write a book only about your successes. But in fact, you also chose to include experiences that you had dealing with legal matters, with malpractice cases and being accused of quackery. And I guess my first question is, why include that in your story? You didn't have to. Why did you choose to?
I didn't have to, but it's the complete story. I mean, nothing is perfect, and I wanted to have the reader realize that life is perfect. We have ups and downs, and I certainly had my downs. I mean, I had cases where I just tore my heart out. It made me total realize that it's not every day is roses. You know, there's tough times ahead, and out of the 15,000 patients that I operated on, and who knows, 100,000 patients that I saw in clinic, I got sued twice, and that idea of when you get served with the subpoena, you feel like that you almost committed murder to your mother. I mean, what they see there is that, I says, this can't be me. They're not talking about me when they're saying that I did this and I did this. I says, I tried to do best I could, and it happened to be things didn't turn out as well as I wanted to, but to have been served and have been disaccused, it's just very surprising and shocking to me. But I wanted to have the reader to see that side as well, that we as physicians, as doctors, as neurosurgeons in my particular case, we go through this, not only all the highs and the glories of successful cases, but we have our complications, and we have indeed patients that thought we maliciously did something wrong, which would obviously be the something that is beyond anybody's thought that I would do that. But for other people to think that I would, that prompted them to foster a lawsuit, which again, twice in my career of almost 40 years of neurosurgery, is the average neurosurgeon gets sued, I think, two or three times a year, and I got sued twice in my whole career. Nevertheless, both of those lawsuits just tore my heart out. It was very personal and demeaning to me that this could possibly happen. But it happened. The lawyers that were on the other side made me feel like I was the devil himself. The way they portrayed me. It was a very humiliating experience. But I got over it and settled both lawsuits on the advice of my lawyer. He thought we could have won both suits, but one suit was involved a patient that had young children, and the other suit turned out to be a distant relative of mine. It's a long story, but we settled both of them and put it behind me, but it certainly made me feel very bad that people would think I would do something intentionally malicious to them.
Both of the suits that you just described, you also indicated that they were settled, and that's often what happens, I would suggest, with these kinds of with malpractice lawsuits. What's your thought about the practice of almost routinely choosing to settle rather than litigate?
Well, you take your chances when you go to that courtroom, according to my legal advice, and even though we thought we had everything on our side, you never know. To be quite honest, both of the cases took months and months, and they're on your shoulders like a big weight, and you get up in the morning, you worry about what happens that day. You get a call from the lawyer or a letter from them, and what's the next process, and it went on and on, and I personally just got tired of it. I just got tired of it, and he says, well, you know, maybe we should suggest settling, I basically said yes, by all means. I just wanted to get over it. I wanted out of it. I wanted that weight off my shoulders.
It has a tremendous impact on malpractice insurance rates, does it not?
Yes, yes, especially neurosurgeons. They pay very high insurance rate, and because, you know, the real estate that we deal in is high real estate, and if something goes wrong, be it inadvertently or because a late infection or late blood clot or something, then yes, the real estate is high and the consequences are severe. Therefore, our insurance is high.
I don't want to know what you pay for your insurance, but give us a sense, as best you know, what the insurance range is in terms of cost.
It varies from state to state. In this state, I think it was $140,000 a year, and other states it's more. I believe Pennsylvania is quite high. Other states are less because they have what they call a no cap, where there's a cap to the malpractice amount of money that can be paid out, like in California and Texas, where they have so much money that the patient can get for suffering, pain and suffering. In Arizona, it's pretty high. We have no limitation on the awards for pain and suffering, so the trial lawyers like that. It's a fair amount of money that we pay to cover ourselves.
It's certainly an expensive endeavor.
Yes.
And the reason I asked you to give us a ballpark figure is because I think a lot of folks really don't realize how expensive malpractice insurance can be. As you have written this book, at the beginning of each chapter, there's a quote that you offer from various people. As we wind down our time today, I refer you to the quote at the beginning of chapter 24, in which you quote Albert Einstein saying, "Try not to become a man of success, but rather a man of valor." Which are you?
I hope that I'm a man of valor. In retrospect, I think I've been very fortunate to have success, but I think valor, honesty, hard work is the essence of my being. I hope that's what I am. I think I have done that in my years as a husband, father, and a physician. So I think I hope that I'm the valor part. And hopefully success comes along with it.
I would like for you to share with the audience a website, a way that they can find out more about you and about the work you're doing.
Yes, there's a website, my name, Volker Sontag, VolkerSontag.com. And the first hit usually is VolkerSontag.com. You hit on that, and then you see the book listed under that. It's usually right on top of the first listing. And that will lead you to the website that supports the book with pictures, also writings, both professional and non-professional writings, and basically kind of supports the book as far as my life, my family, and my career.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Volker Sontag, author of Backbone, The Life and Game-Changing Career of a Spinal Neurosurgeon. I would say that this should be a must-read for anybody considering or in medical school in any discipline, but that's just me. Thank you again very much, Dr. Sontag.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. It is available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org. You can also subscribe to the Mind Talk podcast via iTunes and download the Mind Talk app from iTunes. You can also download the Mind Talk app from Google Play. So there are lots of ways to stay tuned to Mind Talk. And I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to this edition of Mind Talk. So do send an email to me, Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's myndtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it is unacceptable. You take care.